I was elected as a delegate to go to Philadelphia. The state convention is where we make decisions on our state delegates and on our party platform. We're still waiting to actually see the final results of what was agreed to at the state convention. But there were a number of major things added into that, which I think a lot better reflect what progressives, what Democrats in West Virginia want to see. An end to mountaintop removal mining, which does not mean an end to mining. I've been in some Twitter arguments about that on the platform since. It doesn't mean an end to mining just full stop right now. That's unrealistic.
That made it into the West Virginia, Bernie.
That made it into the West Virginia platform, and I believe that there was an amendment of some kind added to the national platform. Now, there have been a couple meetings, one in Orlando, Florida, one in St. Louis. I know we had one West Virginia delegate on the platform committee, and I'm not exactly certain where that fits in, but I do know that's in stark contrast to the Republican platform committee, which had someone from Texas insert, we need to make sure that we put clean in there, clean coal. And we've seen over and over and over and over again that clean coal is a myth. The one system that's working, sort of, in the country is about $1 billion over budget. It might be more than that. And it's only really economically viable in areas where there's oil extraction nearby to buy the carbon dioxide that is captured from the plant, not to mention all the impacts of mining, which include contamination, include health effects from water quality, which include potential increased risk for flash flooding, which is, of course, an interesting issue for West Virginia, complicated one.
What did you mean by buying the carbon dioxide from the coal? How does that work in connection with the oil industry?
So I'm drawing a blank on the name of the plant in the South. It's either Alabama or Mississippi. Pretty sure it's Alabama. The way that whole thing is supposed to work is there are big scrubbers designed to capture the carbon dioxide from burning the coal, convert it to either compress it down to a gas or convert it to a liquid. But its immediate use afterwards is to increase oil production, a sort of gas-stimulated fracturing for oil in nearby oil fields. So it's only that I've seen with current technology, it's only been economically viable, and people have actually invested money into designing this, where there are nearby oil fields to use for oil field stimulation. So if you have that added part of the process where, okay, it's going to help us produce some oil and that will also help subsidize the whole process, that's really the only place where the technology seems to sort of work.
Now, it subsidizes, but what does it do in terms of carbon dioxide capture?
So it does.
Is that really, is it having a significant impact in terms of capture?
There's only been a couple of plants around the world that have been trying this, and technically I think it does work in the sense that if the gas is injected underground as the part of developing oil, the gas does stay trapped in those formations. That's the point of it, at least for the foreseeable future. Now, if you're using carbon to extract more carbon, you could argue that that oil, the carbon dioxide from that oil was always there to begin with. Using carbon dioxide in the process doesn't add any more to that part of the carbon cycle, carbon balance. But it's complicated. The point of it is, we're not to the point that we can just take all the carbon dioxide out of the smokestacks, keep it from entering the atmosphere, and just be done with it. There's other steps to the process. They are complicated. They are expensive. And they don't begin to touch the environmental impacts of extracting the resource to begin with.
What has been the, let me back up a little bit. The West Virginia Democratic platform is primarily driven by Bernie Sanders supporters, as I understand it. because West Virginia did go for Bernie in the Democratic. Is that correct?
Yes, over 60%.
Okay. And what are the main differences between the platform that was developed for West Virginia Democrats and the one that currently is in play with the Democratic Party?
I've not seen enough of the national platform, but I think that West Virginia was more a question of getting us up to speed with where the rest of the country has been for a while. So there's talk. It was included in the Democratic platform for decriminalization and legalization of cannabis. That is something that's being talked about on the national platform. But on the issue of coal, for example. So this year we inserted into that language, not only before the convention ever took place, language that reclamation needs to be complete. That was actually language that myself and fellow member of the Eastern Panhandle Young Democrats, Marguerite Hestand, helped get into the platform, is that reclamation needs to be complete. But on the floor of the state convention, we added in to end mountaintop removal. Contrast that with the 2012 West Virginia Democratic Party platform, where we had all this language supporting clean coal. That was in the West Virginia platform in 2012. Mm-hmm. So every 4 years, the platform is revisited. It's opened back up. And generally how it's supposed to work is that there's a committee that gets together, has a series of meetings, people can submit proposed amendments, changes to language. And this small group of people, I think 17 or so representatives from each state Senate district, get together. They incorporate and massage all the language in to make the changes that have been requested by their constituents. They agree to it. Then they present it on the floor of the platform. And how it's supposed to work is that everyone says yes to Section 1, yes to Section 2, yes to Section 3, and just go down through that and be done with it in 15, 20 minutes. But there were some issues with how everything went leading up to the convention. Nobody had seen the language of the full platform until literally minutes before we were supposed to start voting on it. And so changes were made. People called for the ability to amend from the floor. Normally you have to have a petition of 10 or 20% of delegates that are present to make any kind of change to the platform from the floor. But because nobody had seen anything, everyone said, look, we've got to have some time to work through this and see what we want. So the whole platform was opened up on the floor, and we spent about 4 hours going through it. At one point, it eventually got a little too long. People were injecting every little thing in, not major, massive changes that needed to be approved by acclamation.
Let me ask you specifically, mm-hmm. I've seen that the Democratic platform as it stands now, I saw one summary that said pro-fracking. Now, I don't know if that really means pro-fracking or it means that they have not taken a position against fracking. Now, where did the West Virginia delegation come down on that? And do you know what the stance of the party in general is on fracking?
The platform that was inserted in for an end to fracking altogether in West Virginia. The reality of that is a lot more nuanced, and that was one of the outcomes that I had from a conversation. I'll call it a Twitter argument, that's what it was. Is that a platform is our aspirational goals, and this is what the constituents want. And I don't actually expect every Democrat out there to be running on every single issue in the platform. It just, that kind of consensus rarely happens except on enormous, major issues that we need to have peace and security, we need to have law and order. Otherwise, the nuance of how you get to that is varied. And I don't realistically see West Virginia as a whole banning fracking anytime soon. But I do see that there's opportunity in the state to say we need much stronger protections. We should end it on any kind of public land. If it's land that belongs in trust to the people of West Virginia, that land should not be auctioned off and developed. I've been in wildlife management areas in Wetzel County and that area that have just been industrialized by the process. And this is land that's supposed to belong to all of us, that's supposed to foster and provide refuge for wildlife, another one of our great natural resources. But so to see an end to fracking, that the party would enact that if we elected every Democrat on the ticket, probably not. I wouldn't actually expect to see that, but I would expect to see much stronger regulations on it. I would expect to see more effort to make sure those jobs are going to West Virginians. Right now, we can't know if West Virginians are the ones getting the jobs, or how many jobs are held by West Virginians, how many fracking-related jobs are held by people from out of state.
How about the issue of being able to monitor how much leakage, methane leakage, there is associated with it, and also standards or controls on clean water? Because as I understand it, they do have some exemptions with regard to clean water. Is this correct?
Yes. Yeah, there is the Halliburton loophole, which exempts the whole process from regulation. The actual injection of water and chemicals into the ground is exempted from the Clean Water Act. Now, that does not mean that the surface water that they're allowed to just dump wastewater into streams, that is still against the law. But some of the oversight, some of the reporting requirements are a lot fuzzier. And that's something that SkyTruth has talked about in the past, is that rather than there being strong regulations saying that you have to disclose every chemical that they're using, the industry came along and said, we're going to voluntarily disclose what chemicals we use, except the ones that we choose to withhold under trade secrets, and we're just going to voluntarily do all this and do it on our own terms. And that really blocked a lot of research for a number of years. SkyTruth hammered on that for a while. And finally, that site, it's still largely voluntary, but they have made some major improvements in transparency.
How about the whole issue of inspection? And the amount, the number of inspectors, what they inspect for, and who funds those inspections? It seems to me that the industry should be maybe picking up the tab for that.
We do need more inspectors, and I would certainly say that that could come from increased severance tax on, let's say, natural gas itself. Right now, there's not really much to tax there because there's so much gas on the market, it's worth so little. Because of fracking, actually, that raising a tax on natural gas right now won't do much for our revenue problems. Gas liquids, such as ethane, butane, hexane, all of the other stuff that comes up with natural gas at some wells, not all of them, but some Marcellus wells where they have wet gas, tax on those gas liquids, that could potentially be the revenue source to pay for additional inspections. And I would say that industry should be responsible for the air emissions regulation. You were talking about methane earlier. Mm-hmm. So there's been the idea proposed by many academics, by environmental groups, that you should have downwind monitors all around at the fence line of the well pad that says, that's just constantly recording what the air quality is, how much natural gas, how much carbon dioxide, how much BTEX, that's benzene, toluene, ethene, xylene, from the diesel engines, because they use these large, fairly unregulated diesel engines to run the compressors, to run the engines. There's a lot of emissions just from the diesel alone that's burned on the pad. Air emissions, I would say that industry should be responsible for recording that and should be responsible for submitting that to the DEP for review.
Well, as you said before, the price of natural gas is so low now, but isn't that a result of the fact that they have externalized so much of the cost, such as the global warming, the methane gas, other environmental impacts, the cost of inspection, monitoring, and all the rest of it? It's been shifted over to to be externalized. So if those costs were put back in, wouldn't that push the price up to maybe in a more appropriate level for those fuels?
Possibly, but I think the issue really with the price right now is supply and demand. It's simple economics. There's so much gas on the market. Now, if there were additional restrictions in place, if the full costs of reclamation were being counted in, then yes, companies would have been producing slower. They would not have been playing this shale shell game, as it were. There's been some really dodgy things going on with how gas has been leased, how it's been developed. There was one owner, a fairly active operator in West Virginia, Chesapeake Energy. Their CEO, who was eventually ejected from the company, was some sort of deal that he had. I think he had a 1% share of all profits from each well that was drilled. It's kind of a founder's fee sort of deal, that he had a share of all profits or all gross revenue from that well over the life of it. And he was personally borrowing against the value that was estimated to be produced by that well to finance future well drilling. And they just kept buying and leasing and continuing to transfer the costs forward, borrowing against what value they estimate they had in the ground. And yes, if there had been better controls in there to begin with, I think the whole economics of it would have gone much slower. But the price right now is not so much because consumers aren't paying for the cost of reclamation. It's just because there's so much of it, nobody can get rid of it for the amount that they would like to sell it for.
On another note here, environmental, there's a major problem down in Florida with algae blooms. Is this something that SkyTruth monitors?
It is something we've looked at briefly. A biological side of things has not been quite our main area. Most of our original projects were focused on geological issues, so mining, oil and gas development. But one contributing factor to that is agricultural runoff that is not being funneled direct properly through the old cleaning mechanisms. So in Central Florida, a lot of agriculture, either orange groves or sugarcane production, there's runoff from the fertilizers, runoff from pesticides that all washes into things like Lake Okeechobee. And previously, that water would drain out through the Everglades, which would do its job as a massive wetland and absorb and take out all of that pollution, all of that additional nutrients. And then the water going into the Gulf of Mexico or into the Atlantic would be clean. But there's been a lot of diversion projects, and John was talking about this just yesterday, that they're diverting a lot of that water out of Lake Okeechobee directly to the Atlantic.
Well, I think part of the problem is that I think the cleansing capabilities of the Everglades are up to their limits, and therefore, there's a flood issue, but there's also a limitation on what the Everglades can actually handle in terms of cleaning.
There is, I'm sure, a carrying capacity there, but the main issue, at least with the blooms off Port St. Lucie, are that the water never even goes to the Everglades. It's just being shunted directly from agricultural runoff. It's full of fertilizer, it's full of nitrogen, and goes off into the ocean, and then the algae has a field day.
Right.
And that is something you can see on satellite imagery.
Being diverted from Lake Okeechobee. And the St. Lucie River is basically starts from Lake Okeechobee as a canal, man-made canal, mm-hmm. that connects it with the St. Lucie River. And this was started back in the 20s and then expanded in the 40s. But I think a lot of it has to do with agriculture and development of surrounding the Everglades and Lake Okeechobee. And this has been the reason that they've had to divert the excess water out to sea. So they got a huge problem there, and I don't know how they're going to resolve it.
That seems to happen whenever we get it in our mind that we can overtake and completely rewire natural systems. We have unexpected consequences.
Absolutely. Anything else pressing on your mind, David, on as you look forward to the convention?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of things happening in very rapid fire. I don't know exactly what the outcome will be for Sanders delegates. I know that we need to be there to have these votes on platform issues. I know that in the past there have been amendments injected in that people have disagreed with. So you need to stay present. You need to make sure there's a quorum on the floor and make sure that there's enough of your supporters. Somebody tries to stick in. We support clean coal. That there are people there saying, look, we're from West Virginia. We see that there is no such thing as clean coal. Even if you take the whole carbon issue and fix it, there are huge reclamation issues. There are huge issues with the extraction process. But as far as the convention goes, I think a lot of it will happen in rapid fire. We're probably ordinary delegates like myself are not being given the full picture. We know that Sanders endorsed Secretary Clinton. I personally, if there's no way for him to be the nominee, if superdelegates don't change their mind, I would like to see him tapped as vice president. I don't think that's the Clinton campaign's desired outcome. I know they're talking Tim Kaine or Elizabeth Warren, but I think Sanders is the one who would really bring back a number of people. There would still be a certain contingent that says, Sanders sold out, I'm out of the process altogether, but I think that would be a reasonable compromise. Have the two of them on the ticket, I think that would unite the party, and I think that's really the only thing that would truly bring it together.
Are there some issues that you see where there's going to be a big floor fight in terms of platform?
This maybe not be such a platform issue as is a rules issue, and that's the whole discussion of superdelegates that comes up time and time again. And what's funny is that we have two major parties who've gone through, one with superdelegates and one without. The Republican Party would probably love to have superdelegates right now to restrict the runaway process of a populist vote. But frankly, I think that this is the risk of a democracy. Democracy is messy. And I would much rather have it that it's done proportionally by the numbers, that if you manage to convince a large number of people and too many other people are in the race to dilute the effect of the more rational thinkers out there, then you know, that's a problem that your party needs to fix in coming years. Either side can be manipulated, either a system with superdelegates or without. I would far rather have a pure democracy and take our chances with that.
One more question on that. What do you think is going to happen with, and assuming Bernie is not on the ticket, I actually think that's kind of a safe bet, but
probably
you may disagree. But if he's not on the ticket, what do you see happening with the Bernie supporters, particularly millennials? Where are they going to go? Are they going to go Green Party? Are they going to, what's going to happen with those votes? You have a guess?
It depends on how much acknowledgement of the Sanders movement is incorporated into the platform, how much of it is acknowledged. I didn't quite finish on the earlier one. I got distracted. It might be a rules discussion, the whole procedural thing of how the party handles their nomination. If at the convention Sanders supporters feel that there's been major progress forward and someone progressive like Senator Warren is picked, then maybe more of them will coalesce and say, look, we've made a lot of progress this time, but we're going to be back in 2018. More of a centrist like Tim Kaine, if they reject efforts to amend the platform, if we still have superdelegates, There may be a lot of people who say, I'm going to write in Bernie Sanders. There may be a lot of people who say, I'm voting Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. But what I think is different about this race from even the energy in 2008, Sanders didn't have the numbers that Obama had. He didn't manage to turn superdelegates the way that Obama did. But there are so many more people out there right now that I think have been inspired to run for office. People who are not just out knocking on doors for one candidate. You've had people inspired to change the system. And I think 2018 will be will bear a lot of that fruit, regardless how this cycle turns out. A lot of the races down ballot are already decided, but you're going to see people who, before Senator Sanders would never have thought of running for office, now they're already making plans for 2018.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it will be interesting. In a couple of weeks, we'll know a lot more about this. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the next few days, with the Republicans having their convention, there'll be plenty more to talk about.
Yep.
And Hassan, I'd like to turn to some law enforcement issues. You've been an assistant prosecuting attorney for a number of years in Jefferson County, and you're running for prosecuting attorney.
Yes.
On the Democratic ticket.
Yes.
And what is your impression looking at what has transpired with killings of black men and women also, under very questionable circumstances, as well as the deaths of policemen? How do you look at this from your position where you sit, and what do you think in terms of the justice system can be done to improve the situation, if anything?
Well, first of all, I think one of the things I saw, and especially in the Ferguson cases, we have a police force and a community that are completely hostile to each other. And I think that stems from a number of reasons. One of them, that the community is being policed by police officers who do not live in that community. And the second thing I thought about the Ferguson matter was that there was a very strong incentive, I think pushed by the higher-ups in Ferguson, to make arrests in order to get revenue. And that further, and also, you know, you have most of the white police officers in that community were white, and most of the members of the community were black. And this sort of incentivized, or this push to find petty criminal offenses just so you can create revenue for the local municipality, brings a lot of resentment from those who are being policed. The people in that area feel like they're not being protected and served, rather they're being used as a form of revenue generation. And that part of it brings a very makes the community very hostile to the police force. And once you have that, then you have a police force that feels threatened and scared. And when there are genuine crimes going on, you don't get a lot of cooperation from folks in the community. And so that breakdown, the breakdown of communication, the breakdown of trust, is what sort of leads to the events in Ferguson. And you know, of course, don't know exactly what happened there, but that after the shooting there, the folks in the community felt that this is just another example of a police force that's not is more interested in getting revenue for than protecting the folks in our community, and that hostility just, you know, boiled over.
Now, how are they getting the revenue? Is it like, you mean from like tickets, speeding tickets?
I think it was tickets, petty thefts. They've been heavily policing petty thefts, that sort of thing. Mag Tolbert, actually, city councilman in Charlestown, brought this up at the vigil on last Monday. And I think he made some very good points that if you do this kind of policing against and sort of focus on these small crimes, petty thefts, and sort of try to create, and you know, speedings and parking violations and that sort of thing, just to create revenue, and you're creating a, such an environment in which you have a hostile community and a police force that is now dealing with a hostile community and is not and doesn't have good communication, good relationship with that community.
So these are kind of somewhat discretionary items in a way. I mean, discretionary may be the wrong word when we talk about the makeup of our police force, but it is something that we have control over in terms of whether they represent the community, whether they look like the community, and whether they live in the community, and how they relate with the community. But the other part of discretion is how they put their resources, what things do they focus on. And so now, in your experience in Jefferson County, have you seen an evolution or a change, or has it stayed pretty static as far as priorities and the way that law enforcement goes about its business?
Yeah, it's been pretty static. And I want to say in a good way, because I know all the police chiefs in Jefferson County and most of the officers, and there is by going to the vigil on Monday, which is held by the NAACP, you saw the chief of Charlestown Police Department was there, the chief of the Ransom Police Department was there, the sheriff was there. A lot of local law enforcement people were there in solidarity. So there is, in our communities in Jefferson County, there is a good relationship, an open relationship, a relationship in which the police officers and the prosecutor's office listens to complaints from all the communities and is receptive to those. And I think that is a huge difference between in our community as those in some of the other communities where we've had tensions between law enforcement and the community they serve.
Okay, well, that makes a big difference. And I've noticed just in my little exposure to Martinsburg, the new chief of police seems to be a real benefit to the community, the way he conducts himself, the way he presents himself. And I was at a drug heroin epidemic focused meeting over in Martinsburg on, I guess it was Tuesday night, and really got the impression that things have changed in terms of the way that people are looking at addiction, and which really brings me to the whole subject of the war on drugs and what that has done to police community relations. Instead of treating it as the alternative might be to treat it as a mental health problem for the serious drugs, addictive, and the drugs that wind up in so many deaths. And then for the other things, maybe liberalize, as states have done in regard to marijuana, for example. I heard something stated there that shocked me, and I think I heard it correct, that this is from a statement by Senator Manchin that was read at the meeting, and it was that 90% of the deaths were from prescription drugs. That really shocked me. Now, this to me raises this whole question of, okay, prescription drugs are kind of the sanctioned method of getting opioids, whereas law enforcement's efforts are targeted at the unsanctioned, which is flip side being the heroin on the street, versus oxycodone and other forms of these drugs. But as the war on drugs commenced back in the 70s, I mean, I'm kind of up in years myself, and I think I have a perception that things have shifted quite a bit from the time when the war on drugs was initiated in the relationship between the community and the police. To me, the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, unless you've got you must have a warrant, basically, the Fourth Amendment says. But a lot of the interactions are resulting from traffic stops that trickle over into searches. Could you comment on this as a prosecutor? How do you look at this whole area of the right to conduct searches based on traffic stops?
Well, the Supreme Court has held that, has actually made a distinction between homes and automobiles as to whether or not you need a search warrant for it. There's what's known as an automobile exception, that there has to be, you do have to have some probable cause to believe that there's a crime committed, but it's not as stringent a warrant requirement as you have trying to search someone's home. So there is law that says the police officer can search a car under certain circumstances if he believes that, if he has probable cause to believe that a crime is being committed, such as illegal possession of drugs with the intent to distribute those drugs. And I think what law enforcement has been doing is trying to, especially because heroin is such a major problem in this area, and it's coming in from, and almost everybody knows this, is coming in from Baltimore, to try to stop that flow, that easy access that folks have to heroin around here, if they have somebody pulled over, and they have probable cause to believe that this person is a drug dealer, will have a lot of heroin, and other indicia of selling the drug, then they will conduct a search in order to at least do that part to try to get some of the heroin off the streets.
I wonder how that's kind of how that's come about, this difference between the home and the automobile, because when you read the Fourth Amendment, you get the impression unreasonable search and seizure. I imagine, you know, something back in colonial days, somebody's going down the road and they're free from being accosted. So what's the difference? Are you aware of how that evolved?
I have to go back to my law school days, but I do recall there was a case in the 60s, actually, when there was more liberal interpretation of more protections for people under the Constitution. But even at that time, there was a distinction made, and I think it's United States versus Carroll case, which happened in the late 60s, early 70s, in which they made a clear distinction was made between an automobile and a home because of the mobility of the automobile, that it can be easily moved from place to place. It's not where a person lives, and the person certainly has a privacy interest in what is in the automobile, but because of the mobility, you're at a stop, you have probable cause. Just going back and getting a warrant is excessive or a burden upon that police officer, and the reduced privacy interest. That was the Supreme Court's reasoning in Carroll, and I'd have to look at U.S. v. Carroll again to see what other points they made, but they did make a distinction between the automobile and a home.
Can I throw the monkey wrench in there of what if you live in your car? What if your car is your home?
Well, if you're not driving it around, I think that you would have a stronger argument there. If you're just living in your home and it's like, you know, like a trailer or something, mm-hmm. and it's not being moved regularly, then you would have an argument that it should be treated as a home as opposed to just an automobile.
Okay.
So now going into, let's say, changes that maybe could be made, do you see, I don't know, I know this isn't your role, but being close to all of this, what do you see that changes that could be made within the legal and law enforcement system? Basically, I guess it would require changes in law to lessen the types of interactions that are resulting in deaths. For example, I mean, the first thing that obviously comes to mind is the right to carry. This has put, I think, the police in a ridiculous situation. Number one, they're feeling this authority to conduct searches, and then if somebody's got a gun, you right away have created a situation. Now, you throw into that the fact of racism that we can't ignore in this country, and the fear. I mean, you go back in our history, Second Amendment, there's a lot of literature that this has evolved from slave patrols and the preservation of slave patrols, and that policemen themselves evolved from slave patrols, and that with the white policing of black neighborhoods, this winds up looking like a continuation of that. So you have this tremendous tension between the races in these situations. Is there anything within the legal framework, maybe other than getting the guns out of the picture, which sounds like a very difficult thing to do, but I mean, that's one. But are there other things that could be done within the legal framework to lessen the tension between the citizenry and the police, who start to look more like, you know, seeing the citizenry more like an enemy than a friend?
Yeah, I think the sort of sense of like an occupation by a foreign power. Some of these places seem to think the law enforcement agencies are part of a foreign power. What I've seen that's worked in this community, and I hope that it can be done in other communities, is law enforcement agencies actively participating in community activities, going to those activities. Some segment of the community is saying, "Look, our members, say African American community, say somebody from the NAACP would say, we believe our members, people of that are black are being unfairly targeted or unfairly singled out, and they bring that to a law enforcement officer, bring that to a prosecutor, and then." The prosecutor listens to him, or the law enforcement officer listens to him, finds out what's going on, and reiterates to their own deputies or troopers or patrolmen or however it is that this is not acceptable, that we are not going to be policing people based on their race. I think that's one thing, and I think it's one thing that is happening in Jefferson County, is that isn't done, and that community sense of community and police being on the same side. I think you do that. You have that in this county. The other thing that was brought up, and I think it was brought up at the vigil, and I think it was brought up by Councilman Tolbert again, was the training. I think a lot of these shootings are just simply officers thinking that they are in danger, maybe when they weren't necessarily in the mortal danger that they thought they were in, and how to react in those situations and when to use lethal force and when lethal force is not necessary. And I think multiple trainings and putting the officer in that sort of scenario while he's in that training and how to adequately respond, I think that would be another thing that can be done to lessen these encounters.
Mm-hmm. I would say positively for Martinsburg as well is that I've seen it slowed down because I think a policy came out from authority that they didn't want officers themselves posting too many of these photos, but some officers in Martinsburg taking photos with members of the community that they know, and I think using the hashtag not in our city. So it was a solidarity. It was showing that, yes, we're involved in the community. We know the people that we work with, the people that we protect, that we serve and protect. I do understand the Martinsburg Police Department's position on social media is a tricky one. Hopefully, the officers, the individuals posting this are doing so favorably, but if somebody uses an unfortunate choice of words, that could create an issue. So I kind of understand why Martinsburg Police Department said, please hold off on doing that for now. But I have been seeing photos coming from Martinsburg as well, saying, look, we do know our community. We are involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I'm sensing that as well. I think we've come quite a long way in the last couple of years. It's 2.5 years ago, I guess, that the Wayne Jones killing occurred, where five, I believe they were all white police officers, pumped like 23 bullets into a black man on the street under very questionable circumstances, and then there's never been a trial on that. And there may, it looks like there will be one now that the Court of Appeals has remanded that back to this jurisdiction, that there will be a civil suit which will expose this matter, hopefully, because the people really have no way of seeing that a fair airing has been given in this case. And I just have a doubt that that sort of thing would occur today. I hope so. I certainly hope so. But I think, Hassan, I would be interested if you have any further thoughts on the political process and what it lends to this whole racial question, and the interaction between the police and the citizenry. What areas in, let's say, the Democratic platform or any platform and in legislation would you see that might lend some improvement?
Well, as far as the political process, and I attest to this myself, is that if you know, all, you know, our judges are elected, our prosecutors are elected, you know, our sheriff is elected. So it sort of forces you, and not that you wouldn't want to do this anyway, but you have to go out to every community. And to be elected, you have to go to every community. You have to hear what their thoughts are, what their concerns are, and makes you more involved in their community. And you have to let them know that you're going to represent them, each member of the community, and they can come to your office anytime that you're there, and just come speak to you and let you know about their concerns. And I think that goes a large way in building confidence between the law enforcement community and the community we serve. And so, you know, if you don't have that tension, I think then you don't have what happened in Ferguson, because I think there was just a breakdown in any kind of communication between the community and the police force. So keeping that dialogue open, listening, and being a representative of all communities, I think, is a very important part of what we do in law enforcement. Sorry, I forgot the second part of your question. There was two parts to that question.
Well, legally, I mean, in the legal sense or in the political sense, I do appreciate what you're saying there. That's very significant, I think, about the fact that, for example, you in your shoes are going out into the community and listening to the community. I guess instead of my original question, I'd like to just close with this last question. What is it that you hear that people are most concerned about when they talk to you about your position and the role of the legal system?
The concern that is always brought up to me, no matter where I go, and this probably won't surprise anyone, is the heroin issue and the crimes that are committed as a result of folks who are addicted to heroin. We have a large spike in number of burglaries. We're now having, and it's very concerning, a number of home invasions that are occurring. We usually get one or two of those a year. We've had about six in the last couple of months. So addressing and finding a way to address the heroin and the other substance abuse problems in the community is going to be a large part of what we need to be doing in the coming years, because that is where a large part of the crime is coming from. So I'm hoping there has been some progress made. There's been a drug court, a juvenile drug court, some other avenues that we can, instead of placing people in jail, sending them to different treatment programs. I don't think there's enough yet, not nearly enough, to address. This is a crisis that we're dealing with right now with the heroin problem, and it needs to be treated that way. And really need some help from state or federal levels to fund some programs that can address this issue, because that's the biggest problem facing our community right now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, David. Thank you, Hassan. Really appreciate your thoughts, and we'll keep in touch with the issues. Thank you. This is that concludes Seven Generations Radio for today, and be back in 2 weeks with another show. Thank you for listening. You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown, and John and Carol will be in momentarily with their Good News Radio. So hang in there.